Our guest has been on the front line of America's public health challenges and has distilled his experience into a framework to understand healthy lives. He shares his thoughts in a new book.
What we've seen from Europe, and Europe usually has an earlier flu season than we do, is they're having the worst flu season they've had in years this year. So if that comes here and we have lower flu vaccine rates, that means more hospitalizations.
Dr. Tom Frieden served as director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and he served as commissioner of the New York City Health Department. He now leads Resolve to Save Lives, which works with partners to accelerate action against the world's deadliest health threats.
So the superpower of public health is to see the invisible. We can see things that aren't apparent. It may be microbes spreading in certain ways, or toxins harming people in certain ways, or programs that we thought were doing great that are actually failing, or vice versa. And to see the rigorous pathway to progress, that if you do X, you will get Y in terms of health outcomes.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Dr. Frieden, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's great to speak with you again.
Your book is titled The Formula for Better Health, How to Save Billions of Lives, Including Your Own. You criticize the Food and Drug Administration. Right now, there are press reports that the Trump administration is frustrated with the leadership of the current FDA commissioner. What's your take on his management of the FDA?
I really can't comment on that. I don't know what's going on inside of the administration. What I do know is that we have a way to save a lot of lives. And if we use this proven approach, this formula, we can save millions of lives, and we can apply it to primary care. We can apply it to personal health and wellness. And the formula is see, believe, create. So take an FDA action on something like sodium. The FDA has the power to improve our food, or on tobacco. It has the power to reduce the amount of addictive nicotine in cigarettes, but it's not doing it. So if our focus can be single-mindedly on making our society such that if you just go with the flow, you're not going to end up sick, disabled, or dead at a young age.
So it's not really personal, it's really professional, your observation of what's happening there.
Yeah, I think what we see when it comes to health progress is that there's a reason that bad things happen. It's not just that people are mean or not paying attention. It's that the economic forces and our personal perceptions are such that it makes health challenging. And that's why this formula of see, believe, create is essential. We need to see the threats, see the trends, see why we're not taking action, and see the rigorously proven path to progress. We need to strengthen belief that we can change things, because if you think it's hopeless, you're not going to try to change things. And we need to work systematically to create a healthier future.
Well, let me pick up on that a little bit, because it seems if we were starting at baseline, and I think it's probably been 2 years or so since we've had a chance to chat with you, our work would be cut out for us, right? If we're starting at baseline of where we've been with all of the issues you described, from tobacco to sodium to diet and everything else. But you've also noted that we are at a time where we've been seeing a destruction or deconstruction of our public health protections. And I'm wondering how you see the opportunity to achieve some of the goals you just laid out by rebuilding public health. Where is the most important place to start in rebuilding what we seem to have been somewhat taking apart in public health?
Well, first, I think we have to do everything we can to stop the destruction. There are big problems happening with our vaccine policy, with attacks on the CDC. Quarter of the staff have been fired or left. Most of the leadership has left or been fired. We have political appointees running the organization in a big group. That's never happened before. Second, medical institutions, states, cities, localities, academic institutions need to fill gaps when they're needed. For example, the American Academy of Pediatrics giving vaccine recommendations that are based on facts and protecting children. So I think stop the bleeding, patch where possible, but also we're never going back. We need to go forward. And that involves a public health system that's faster, that listens better to communities and communicates more effectively, that has alliances and partnerships with primary healthcare and many, many other entities, and that delivers benefits that people can feel.
You know, Margaret, I was thinking back to the beginning of the pandemic when we were talking about everybody talking about public health and how its stock rose during that time. And Dr. Frieden, you were just talking about maybe it's not going to happen out of Washington. It's going to happen at the state and local level. Doesn't seem to be a lot of conversation going on at that level or the resources needed. So is that a, is that something we can count on, or do we have to maybe look elsewhere?
Well, we are seeing a Northeast collaborative that's bipartisan of health departments getting together. We're seeing other groups work, but I think there's no substitute to a competent federal government.
Right.
It has to be there. It has to do things that no other entity can do. But if it's not doing those things, then we have to do what we can to protect people and keep the health safety net that is so essential going, whether that's finding and stopping outbreaks sooner or supporting smokers who want to quit or preventing cancer.
Mm-hmm. Well, at this moment in time that we're talking, we're at peak season for flu and COVID, certainly seeing that in our own organization. There are news reports that the changing federal guidelines about vaccines have created confusion, have resulted in fewer shots in arms. I think vaccines are less readily available in some areas and costing more money, which is another factor. From where you sit, are you following the data on this? How do you think things are looking, both in terms of protection with vaccines, but also in terms of actual cases?
It's not good. We're seeing a significant decrease in uptake of both COVID and influenza vaccines, possibly a decrease also in the RSV vaccine. And I think we have to be really clear that things change over time. And in the book, The Formula for Better Health, I outline what it is to be technically rigorous. We have to recognize that microbes change with time, our immunity changes, vaccines change, the environment changes. I think people have gotten used to that for influenza, that every flu season is different. The only thing you can predict about influenza is that it's unpredictable. But what we've seen from Europe, and Europe usually has an earlier flu season than we do, is they're having the worst flu season they've had in years this year. So if that comes here and we have lower flu vaccine rates, that means more hospitalizations, more sick days, less productivity in the economy, and sadly, more deaths. Now, the flu vaccine is not ideal. It's not one of our best vaccines, but it is the best tool we have to protect against the flu.
You know, I pick up on vaccines and in particular COVID vaccines. You have stated that you do not believe that certain institutions should have mandated health professionals to get COVID vaccines. That's a controversial take in some circles. Talk to us about the evolution of your thinking here.
Sure. That's not quite what I say in the book. So what I outline is the mandate for mandates. Right. So I started my career as a tuberculosis specialist, and we had patients in New York City who had been admitted to hospitals more than 30 times and had walked out. And they then had multi-drug resistant tuberculosis that they spread to healthcare workers, family, and others. So in that situation, we were able, with full respect for civil rights, to make sure that they were detained in a healthcare facility, and we couldn't forcibly medicate them. That's a very messy thing to do. You have to put a nasogastric tube down somebody. That's not something, but we were very clear. You're going to stay here till you're cured. So you can either take your medicines and leave, or you're here indefinitely. And they all took their medicines. But that, I think everyone can agree on. When the initial data came out about COVID, the COVID vaccines, in the first month or two, they seemed amazing. The people who had gotten vaccinated in that first month or two didn't get infected. And so the initial hope was that the COVID vaccine would prevent you, would block infection. As months three and four and more time passed, it became clear, no, actually that protection fades after a month or two, but there's still a protection for at least 3 to 4 to 6 months against hospitalization, mm-hmm. and much less of a reduction in the risk that you will spread to others. When that information came out, the COVID vaccine stopped being more like a measles school entry requirement, so other kids don't get measles, you know, have a big outbreak in the school, and more like a motorcycle helmet mandate, where you're mandating someone to do something for themselves. And that's a much higher bar that we need to get. Remember, public health does various types of mandates. Most of them are not on individuals. Most of them are on companies. Don't pollute our water. Don't poison people with contaminated food. I think people understand that type of mandate. But mandating people to do something for their own good, that's something that you have to step back and say, you know, it's a tough decision. Each community should make it in a democratic way and then live with it. I do say that there is an exception for employers. If you're an employer and you need to keep your workforce healthy, or you need to make a reduced risk of your workers infecting others, then there may well be a case for an employer-based mandate. But that's different. And I have to say in this, the issues are pretty complicated. So flu vaccination of healthcare workers, there's legitimate controversy on how much does it protect others. Some of the articles that came out were very strong, that there was a huge protection. There's been critiques of those articles. So I think, you know, science doesn't give you certainty. Science gives you humility that you need to learn more to figure out what's happening.
Could science have made a difference at that point? It seemed to be such a dramatic point globally, the COVID epidemic. And also there was real quick sort of evaluation of the COVID vaccine at that time, right? Because there was a rush to get it out there. It seems like it was just a different type of environment than you're necessarily describing, with smaller, discrete problems. This is a global one. So,
I mean, there's one issue is making it easy for people to get vaccinated. Still, the major reason people don't get vaccinated is that it's not easy. So make it easy in pharmacies, improve primary health care so everyone has their own doctor. I had a close friend in his 90s, he's passed since, living in the UK. And when the vaccines came out, you know, he was way up on the list. He got a call from the nurse saying, would you like to come in next Tuesday for a vaccine at 11:30? You're going to have to stay for 15 minutes after. He said, yes. He said, okay, come in. I mean, what a difference in a country that has had a competent primary care system.
Yeah.
Well, we certainly spent a lot of time during the COVID pandemic getting vaccines in the arms of folks. But I know that you are very excited about your new book, and I'd love to have you talk about the formula that you described. This, and you referenced it a few moments ago, mm-hmm. the see, believe, and create formula. Tell us where that idea originated and how it works.
I've been working on this book for a decade because I realized that there's a huge gap between what we know and what we do. And I've been trying to work through how do we close that gap. And I run the organization Resolve to Save Lives. I founded it 8 years ago. And in creating this organization, I had to kind of systematize the lessons, not just from what I've done, but from what people have done in public health for hundreds of years, and to really analyze what works and why, and what's replicable, what will really make a difference. And it does come down to these three phases: see, believe, create. And see is about understanding what the threats are, understanding if our programs are working, understanding why we don't take action, and I think we should come back to that, and understanding the path to progress. So the superpower of public health is to see the invisible. We can see things that aren't apparent. It may be microbes spreading in certain ways, or toxins harming people in certain ways, or programs that we thought were doing great that are actually failing, or vice versa. And to see the rigorous pathway to progress, that if you do X, you will get Y in terms of health outcomes. But you then have to believe you can change it. And there are systematic ways to strengthen that belief, recognizing past progress, making phased progress in multiple areas, and cultivating optimism. And then you have to do the hard part. After you see the invisible and believe the impossible, the really hard part is to create a healthier future. And to do that, you have to be very systematic. You have to organize your activities, you have to prioritize, you have to simplify, you have to communicate effectively, and you have to overcome barriers, because there always are barriers to health progress.
You know, you write about how the public health falls victim to what you call the Cassandra curse. I wonder if you could tell us about it and the strategies you suggest for overcoming it.
Yeah, this is the crux of the matter. In fact, the working title of the book was How to Break Public Health's Cassandra Curse, but not many people remember.
New diagnosis.
So Cassandra, again, the priestess from Greek mythology who could foresee the future, but no one believed her warnings. So the tragedies that she could foresee came to pass. And it all too often, not just public health, but we as individuals have a Cassandra curse, where we can tell what's going to happen in the future, but we don't act on it. So the first question is, why does that exist? And the second question is, how do we break it? And why does that exist ends up a pretty complicated question. And I think it comes down to one fundamental concept. Our perceptions are inaccurate. You know, we trust our eyes, we trust what we sense, but we don't see a lot of things. And our perceptions of ourselves, our perceptions of the world, and our perceptions of the future, all of those are inaccurate. And I'll mention two of them in particular. One of them is our perceptions of the world. We may not recognize what causes the greatest health harm and the greatest health gain. A wonderful public health thinker by the name of Jeffrey Rose coined the term the prevention paradox. And what the prevention paradox says is the biggest health changes in society come from little changes in lots of people rather than big changes in a few people. Now, for example, if you reduce lead, maybe nobody senses the difference, but collectively, the difference is massive. If we eliminate trans fat, in my group, the Resolve to Save Lives has worked with more than 50 countries to ban trans fat, 9 million people aren't going to die from heart attacks as a result. But not one of them will know that their life was saved by this action. So you have what the economists and political scientists call concentrated costs and diffuse benefits. So let's put a pin, and we're going to come back to that. That's one of the causes of the Cassandra curse. Another cause is that our perceptions of the future are inaccurate. There's something called, to use another fancy term, hyperbolic discounting, which is basically shortchanging the future. And I'll make you an analogy from time management. I used to accept speaking engagements, and I'd show up and I think, oh, why did I accept this? I'm just too busy to do this now. So once I learned about hyperbolic discounting, I use a heuristic. I say, okay, if I get an invite, if it were tomorrow, would I want to do it? And if the answer is no, then I don't do it if I can get out of it. This is understanding hyperbolic discounting and using that understanding to break our shortchanging of the future. Look, half of tobacco users will be killed by cigarettes. If smokers knew they had a 50-50 chance of dropping dead after their next cigarette, not a lot of people would smoke.
Right.
So We have to break those two things. But I want to come back to this issue of concentrated costs and diffuse benefits, that we help everyone a little bit and some groups, whether it's the tobacco industry or the junk food industry or whoever, are strongly opposed. To overcome that, we need to be very systematic and not just say, oh, we need more political will. We need to say, okay, who are the winners and losers? Who are the deciders and influencers? What's the advocacy approach and who are the partners who can take it over the finish line? What's the timing? What's the window of opportunity? And what pragmatic compromises may we have to make? Because we can make progress, but it requires being very systematic to overcome the fact that, yeah, everyone's going to benefit, but nobody who benefits is going to organize and push for it. So we've got to arrange that.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. I think it's been about 2 years since we've last chatted with you. And I remember at the time, it really stuck with me that you said if all of us engaged in primary care had a absolute laser focus, almost a singular focus on ending hypertension, it would be the most important thing that we could do. And now I know that you've predicted that heart attacks and strokes will become as rare as forgotten killers. Another incredibly positive and somewhat dramatic statement. But I'm really curious, where do you find the optimism on that one? What's the base on which you're saying that? Aspirational, or do you see some indications this might actually be something we can do?
I actually think it will happen. We ignore how deadly the epidemic of heart attacks and strokes is. And it's deadly despite it being largely preventable. Most heart attacks and most strokes can be prevented with today's technologies. And they come down to the six keys to healthy living that I review in the book: healthy blood pressure, healthy lipids, physical activity, get enough sleep, avoid toxins, and eat healthy. And there are a lot of details on what that means. But with blood pressure, it's increasingly very clear that anything over 120 is not healthy. And optimally, you really want to control to that. We have really good treatments for lipids now. Not statins are great, and there are other medications as well. So I think we have the real potential to make heart attacks and strokes quite rare. There was just a fascinating article published this week of Swedish medical recruits. Their blood pressure was measured at age 18, and their coronary arteries were imaged decades later. And those who had even quote unquote mild elevations in blood pressure had much more atherosclerosis in middle age. Now, if you go back to some traditional studies, communities that consumed very little sodium had no hypertension. Their blood pressure was 90 over 60 at age 16 and 90 over 60 at age 60.
You know, your book offers a look back to the launch years of the Million Hearts Initiative, and the goal was to prevent 1 million heart attacks and strokes over 5 years. And you write candidly that the community aspects of the campaign failed. What did we all learn from that experience?
Yeah, I go through in the book successes and failures, because the only real failure is one you don't learn from. And so the community aspects failed because of this concentrated costs and diffuse benefits problem. The tobacco industry, the food industry, the beverage industry in particular blocked those actions. But the clinical part of Million Hearts failed because of the economic structure of our healthcare system that, as you know well, we don't prioritize primary health care. And this is a deadly problem. In most of our healthcare system, if you put in a lot of extra effort and your patient doesn't have a heart attack or stroke, your healthcare system will make less money. If you fail to control their blood pressure and your patient has a heart attack or stroke, your system will make a lot more money. Now, I don't think there's a single doctor in the country who wants their patient to have a heart attack or stroke. But because that's the way we structure our healthcare system, that's what happens. And if you look at Kaiser Permanente, the group that pays is the same as the group that provides the care. And they realized, oh, We really have to control blood pressure. So they're at 90% control. The rest of the country is at 45% control.
You know, most of these things that we're talking about all have a tie back to if only, right? We could do a better job with prenatal care. We could do a better job with early childhood and certainly preventing obesity in kids and inactivity in kids. Where does that fit in with your view of where we should be as a country with public health and initiatives to get to this end goal of, as you say, the 19-year-old having a blood pressure of 90 over 60 and still having it years later? What do you see around children's health in particular that you find hopeful in the country or promising?
We all, I think, can agree that we want to live in a world where our children reach adulthood with healthy habits of sleep and use of digital and not addicted to drugs or alcohol or tobacco, at a healthy weight with healthy nutrition habits. But right now, that is a rare exception. And that's not because parents are bad. That's because we have a lot of influences in society that make it hard for us as parents to raise kids in a healthy way. So we can get together without any discussion of partisanship or values other than that we value our children and we want them to reach their full potential and think about how we can adjust our communities to maximize the likelihood that that will happen.
You know, I want to spend a little time on the work that you're doing now. You lead the nonprofit Resolve to Save Lives. It's attracted lots of philanthropic support. Congratulations. I'm wondering if you could explain how it works on epidemic prevention, blood pressure control, and other threats.
Thanks. Resolve to Save Lives works in more than 40 countries. Actually, the proceeds from this book will go to groups and projects that Resolve to Save Lives supports to work for health. And the fundamental concept is that we partner with communities and with countries to scale up solutions to the world's deadliest problems. We identify a way forward and then work with countries to prototype approaches to address the problem, to prove that they can be scaled up, and to scale them up and sustain them. So we partner with countries. We kind of walk the pathway of knowledge. We don't have special knowledge. We have experience from multiple countries that we can bring to bear in other countries. And we're there to build capacities, to start systems, to scale up systems that will be able to sustain long-term to make the world a safer place and a healthier place. Because health is not a zero sum. Health is a win-win. If other countries are healthier, we're better off also, less at risk from outbreaks, living in a world that has a more vibrant economy with people who can buy our stuff or sell us stuff that we want, with less civil strife. So the focus is maximizing health, taking a really rigorous view to what works and what can be sustained.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Friedan, for joining us. Thank you to our audience for being here. Just a reminder to be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube and find us on Facebook and X, and share your thoughts and comments about this program. Take care and be well. Dr. Friedan, thank you so much for joining us again on the show.
Thank you so much, and thank you for what you do.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.